Welcome back to another episode of The Sweet Spot. This is John Sherman from Practical Golf, and I am joined by...
And out of breath, Adam Young from Adam Young Golf.
He was lifting weights before we started this episode, by the way.
For the first time in like 6 months.
Nice.
I'm so out of breath right now, but I'll try and catch up with you.
Okay, just don't breathe heavy into the microphone like Nick Faldo does on the CBS broadcasts.
I can't stop it. Whenever I listen back to our episodes, I'm breathing so heavily. I think it's post-COVID lung. Sorry, I do apologize to everybody for that, but maybe you haven't even noticed it and now you are going to, so.
You just totally messed yourself up.
Yeah.
In any event, first off, we just want to thank everyone. We've got thousands of golfers around the world listening to this podcast, giving us feedback. It's awesome. We really appreciate it. We're going to do not necessarily an ad read, but, you know, just a quick how you can support Adam and myself. We both do our golf sites as a full-time job. So you can always go to Practical Golf, which is practical-golf.com. Sign up for my newsletter. Check out our deals section, which is all products I support and use myself. I've got really good discounts on them. Launch monitors, GPS, range finders, training aids. So check that stuff out. And Adam, how can our listeners support you?
This is going to go out before Sunday, isn't it? So people will have an opportunity to get in on my 8-week course still. So if this is before the 9th of May, go on to adamyounggolf.com, have a look at my 8-week course, because I've got a live course going on there. If not, I've got other programs, accuracy plan, strike plan, next level golf, that go through a lot of golf education to improve you. But one of the free things that you guys can do to support us is just give us a review on the Apple or whatever podcast you use, but give us a 5-star review. That would be really good for us. I think we've got up to 100 now. I think we crossed over the 100 barrier.
We actually just cracked 100. So thank you for everyone for supporting us. Much appreciated. So last week we did wedges part one. This is our first 2-part podcast episode here. So we're going to do part two because we really didn't get into everything we wanted to. We want to talk about some other wedge topics. So if you didn't listen to episode one, you can go back to that. Check it out first before you listen to this one. I don't know if it's necessarily sequential, but this is what we're doing. So what do we want to start off with here? Are we talking about the equipment side of wedges?
Yeah, let's do equipment. I say the first thing I will say about equipment that we didn't even touch on last time is, and I've put this in my notes in massive, bolded capital letters, stop using a pitching wedge for pitching. We didn't mention this, so this is one of the first things I mentioned in lessons. Guys, pitching wedges used to have 52 degrees of loft on them back in like Hogan's day. Now, manufacturers have decided to lower the lofts. Over the course of many years, they've lowered it. So I think my pitching wedge at the moment is about 44 degrees of loft. That's like an old 8-iron, maybe even a 7-iron from the 50s. So it's not designed to loft the ball up in the air anymore. So if you're going to be doing pitching, for the most part, use something with 52 degrees or more of loft in general. It's very rare that I would use a 44 degree pitching wedge, other than when you have a full pitching wedge into the green, which nowadays is like 140, 150 away.
My pitching wedge, I think, is 43 or 44 degrees. I can't remember the last time I used it for a shot under, I don't know, 115 yards, depending on wind. Yeah, I think that's a good point. We'll get into loft. That's a good segue to the equipment end of it. First, I want to give credit to my good friend Woody Lashin from Pete's Golf. They're one of the best fitters in the world. They're in New York. So if you are in the New York metro region, they're the best fitters to use. So I've kind of been an apprentice to Woody over the last 6 or 7 years, and I've learned a lot. So I'm just going to give a quick overview. We could do a whole episode on wedge fittings, and I do think it's perhaps one of the most important piece of equipment to get custom fit for because there are so many variables involved. So I'm just going to go through a few of them, and Adam, you can chime in with your thoughts. First of all, getting the lofts correct is really important because of what Adam just said. We're in a situation now where modern golf clubs have much more aggressive lofts than they used to. So my stock pitching wedge, I hit it about 135 to 140 yards. So it's important to get the right mixture of lofts in your wedges based on, you know, the end of the bag in terms of your pitching wedge, or even if it's a 9-iron for certain players. So if I hit that 140 yards and I have a 56 degree wedge, my full swing is about 110. I need a gap wedge. So it's important to get the right mixture of lofts to make sure that you don't have this enormous gap in full swing shots. So for me, my pitching wedge, I have a 50 degree gap wedge, which is about 125 yard. I have a 56 degree, which is 110. And then my lob wedge, I can hit that about anywhere from 90 to 100 yards. So getting the lofts right is super important. Any thoughts on that, Adam?
I was just thinking about my gapping. I've got the highest loft I actually have is 56.
That's quite uncommon these days. I guess that depends on what you have at the top of your bag too. You know, if you want to have one less wedge, you can add an extra club at the top of your bag. So there's a decision there.
I'm very comfortable manipulating the club,
like
opening the face and things like that. So I wouldn't suggest it for most people. I'd suggest having one club that has a higher loft than 56. But yeah, I've got 56, then 52, then 48, then 44. And then I don't even know. That's my pitching wedge, 44. And then I don't know what my 9-iron is, but there's around about 4 degrees of loft between them, around about.
So the best way to get that evaluated, if you work with a fitter, they'll put you on a launch monitor and they can kind of benchmark your distances, because sometimes I've had situations where I've needed to have wedges bent either, you know, 1 or 2 degrees stronger or weaker. Sometimes your club can bend over time. You know, if you use your sand wedge a lot, it can bend. You can always get that checked out from time to time with a, you know, swing professional as a launch monitor or a club fitter. I would say the next, perhaps most important thing to get right is lie angle. We've discussed this in other episodes. Lie angle is you want your golf club to be level with the ground when it makes impact. And as loft increases, lie angle becomes more important, because if your club is too upright at impact, let's say the toe is in the air, it's not hitting the ground, for a right-handed golfer, that actually could cause your shots to go left, and vice versa. If it was too upright, you might be missing your shots more to the right. So as loft increases, lie angle becomes more important. So that's another thing you can get checked out on, like a launch monitor, like the GC Quad. It will show you a picture of how your golf club is interacting with the ground at impact. For me, my club is usually way too upright, so my wedges are 2 degrees flat. I think a lot of club fitters prefer flatter wedges for most players for a number of reasons. But long story short, if you don't have lie angle correct on your wedges, you're going to decrease your chance of hitting more accurate shots, which is huge. You don't want to have a bigger dispersion left to right if you don't have to. So you're making golf harder for yourself. So getting the lie angle correct on your wedges is super important. Also, because you just want the club interacting with the ground properly as well. You want the whole bottom sole of the club to be level with the turf as much as possible.
Yeah, it's very tough to have a non-fit wedge for you. It's that loft effect. We actually call it dynamic face plane tilt. And the easy way to think about that is, if you stick a tee on the face of your club, it will point in a given direction. And then as you lift the toe up, that tee will point more to the left. As you go more toe down, that tee will point to the right. So face angle is actually a 3D angle. And lie angle makes a huge difference on that 3D angle.
Super important. If anything, in a custom fitting you want to get right, even with your irons, I would say lie angles perhaps one of the most important things to get right. And as I said, it gets more important as loft increases. So
yeah, when you get down to a driver, it actually doesn't matter much at all.
Yeah, it has some influence, but not nearly as much. So if you just go into a store and buying a regular wedge and not having it evaluated, you are leaving it up to chance that, you know, the lie angle is not correct. And like I said, you're making it a little bit harder for yourself to hit your targets.
What about bounce?
Bounce. So this is a somewhat misunderstood part of wedge design. I think we all talk about bounce, but one thing I've learned from Woody and all the guys at Pete's Golf is that the number that you see, like if there's like a 12 degree bounce on the club, that's not always accurate. The effective bounce might be different. What's more important with wedges is you want to have a variety of sole designs, meaning it's not just about bounce, it's the sole width, the radius of the leading edge of the club, and how much relief is built into the wedge. So we often say like more bounce gives more relief, which is correct, but there's some other things involved. Like if you go on Titleist Vokey's site, you know, they have a K grind and all these different grinds, and that can be confusing, and I'd let the fitters worry about that. But the main point I'll get across very quickly here is that you want to have variety in wedge design for the shots you like to play around the course. Like some players like to open the face up a bit more and lob it a little bit more. Your turf conditions, you know, if you're playing in drier or firmer conditions versus wetter and softer conditions, that also should be taken into account based on the design of the wedges you're getting. So I'll just go through my bag, for example, and I think this is a pretty generic thing that most golfers it would work for. So I have three wedges. I have a gap wedge, 56 sand, and 60 lob. So my 56 degree, my sand wedge, has the most relief built into it. It's a super wide sole. I think there's 14 degrees of bounce. So that wedge is going to be used more in the situation like the bunker. And I think, you know, Adam can talk more about the technical aspects of using the bounce. So I'm going to use those shots where I need more relief, perhaps in the rough a bit more. I'm a big shaft leaner, so because of that, exposing the leading edge of the club more, and I need more relief. So that's a great club for me when I feel like, okay, I'm in the bunker, I'm in a tough lie, I'm going to use my sand wedge because there's more relief built into this club. Whereas my lob wedge does not have as much. So perhaps if I have a tighter lie where I need to dig a little bit more, I would use the lob wedge. So you want to have some variety in the wedges in your bag. And again, I would lean on a club fitter to determine this for you. They'll kind of interview you about your turf conditions, the shots you'd like to play. They'd probably evaluate your launch monitor results. Like if you put me on a launch monitor, you see I have like a tremendous amount of shaft lean, which means I'm going to need more relief built into my wedges because I have, you know, when you are positioning your hands more forward at impact, you're just exposing the leading edge of the club. So it's going to dig more. So to counteract that, I need more relief built into it. What do you think about that?
I think of bounce as a few things. The angle, as you said, so whether it's 12 degrees of bounce, 4 degrees of bounce, and also the thickness of the sole. So you could have two clubs with 10 degrees of bounce, but if you have a thinner sole, that leading edge is not going to be sitting up as high. Whereas if you have 10 degrees of bounce and you have a very thick sole, then that leading edge is going to be sitting up higher. So there are all sorts of things that determine what bounce you need, such as whether you lean the shaft forwards a lot or not, and the type of turf you're playing off as well. As you said, a good club fitter is going to determine that for you, but ultimately you do need a few different types because we encounter different lies. As you said, sometimes you need less bounce. If you're on a very tight lie, there's no cushion underneath the ball. And sometimes more bounce can be beneficial. It gives you a bigger margin for error.
I would say for most golfers, the people that I talk to who are fairly knowledgeable about wedge play and wedge design, I would say that they are on the side that most golfers need the relief. Think of bounce and more relief built into the wedge with the sole design. It's like a safety net for when things don't go properly. Like, you know, a pro golfer, you could give them no bounce at all and just give them the leading edge of the club. They'll figure out a way to make good contact with the ball on the ground and not dig too much. Not to say that they don't use the bounce, but they're more skilled with those things. Whereas a higher handicap player, they're not always striking the ground properly, and they need a little bit more relief built into the club. And for most people, they're playing in turf conditions that would dictate that. So I would say most golfers are going to want at least one wedge with a decent amount of relief built into it. And again, that would be, you know, subject to the club fitter verifying all that information.
As a junior, I remember we took an old wedge and we ground the bounce off it. I think we did it so much it was negative bounce. And it was horrible to use. So if you caught just a tiny bit behind it, it would just stub straight into the ground. So
yeah, bounce beaver pelts.
Yeah. Bounce really helps stop it digging. So if you are to hit slightly behind it, it bounces. But it also forces debris underneath the club as well. It forces it underneath the leading edge. So when you are hitting just a little bit behind it, any grass will get pushed below the club, or more grass and debris will get pushed below the club. So it leaves a cleaner ball and face interaction as well. But however, bounce can hurt as well. If you have too much, then the leading edge will sit too high above the base of the ball. So say, for example, you place a ball on a hard tabletop or pavement and you have a lot of bounce, then you literally can't get the leading edge of the club and to slide under the ball effectively. It's always going to be thin. And so, yeah, you can have too much bounce as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. So like I'll give a couple of examples on the course where I try and use my wedges differently. So for example, let's say if I was in like an area where it was hard pan and not a lot of grass and kind of like exposed dirt lie, I would use my lob wedge and almost shaft lean a bit more, because I know that there's no chance I can use, if I try and bounce it off this like hard pan surface with no grass on it, the bounce will skid off the ground and I could blade it. Because as Adam says, the leading edge of the club is kind of raised up above the ground. So almost I'll exaggerate trying to dig the club, and ground interaction will become paramount in that situation, because I need to strike it very cleanly. I have no room for error. If I strike it 2 inches behind the ball, I'm digging. And if I am going to bottom out too far in front of the ball, I'm going to blade it. So that's the situation. Or if I was in a bunker with like not a lot of sand beneath it, I'm going to need to dig more, versus if I had a fluffier lie in the rough or the bunker, then I can engage the bounce of the club more. That's what it's for. It's kind of to keep the club going through that, gliding through that fluffiness, so to speak. You don't want it to dig in that situation. So it's an important concept to understand, maybe not so much through an audio format, but it's very important for technique, because I didn't understand this stuff a lot of times. I mean, are you a proponent? When you think of technique and bounce, what are you suggesting to players? Like, I think the modern method of wedge play is to kind of have your hands arriving to the ball at the same time, so you can engage the bounce, versus having that, like, I know you talked about the hinge and hold last episode with Mickelson. I know technically you can't do it, but it speaks to like having your hands really far ahead of the ball at impact with more shaft lean.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the modern, as you said, when we talk modern, we're talking like last 5 to 10 years or so. And I think it stemmed from guys like Siekman, Stan Utley, guys like that. So they are more proponents of using the bounce. And what that would mean is you would tend to come into impact with less forward shaft lean. So it's actually more of a, you could say, a scoopy method in a way, which is fine. I mean, scooping, I suppose when people think of scooping, they think of falling on the back foot, everything collapsing. I'm not talking that.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing with wedge play.
I'm talking about letting the wrists hinge and unhinge nicely. And yeah, it's a really good thing if you get that club to bounce on a good spot, you know, within an inch either side of the ball, then you're going to get good results with it. I think prior to that, the technique was by Peltz, or popularized by Peltz. I'm sure there are other guys who did it as well, which is much more of a forward shaft leaning position. So that actually reduces bounce. Now, the reason I believe why he did that is because when you have the ball back, you put your weight forward, you lean the shaft forward, all of those things help to move the low point forwards. So it helps create a steeper angle of attack. And that can, for many people, help to move the ground contact forwards. However, it comes at a cost. And the cost is you reduce the bounce and you have a steeper angle of attack. And so the problem here is if you hit the ground just an inch behind now with that combination, it's a disaster. And so I think there's a balance between a scooping action and a Peltz action. But I also think both ends of the scale can be valuable. I might use more of a Peltz action when I have a bad lie. If I'm in a divot, or I have something behind the ball, I'm in thick rough, I might use that steeper angle attack with less bounce. Whereas when I have a stock lie, I might use something more like a Siekman or an Utley uses, which has more bounce and more loft.
Yeah, I think, you know, for most lies and most golfers, again, I play with a guy who's a scratch golfer. He chips the ball literally with the ball like outside of his right foot, and he just kind of gets it going and runs it from everywhere. He's incredible with it. I wouldn't tell all golfers to do that, because he's not using the bounce at all. There's no relief on that shot, but his ground contact and low point control is extremely good. So I'd say, you know, most golfers stand to benefit from a more neutral you don't have to get super flippy and scoopy with it, but at least hands, perhaps like you said in the last episode, a little bit of shaft lean, not too much, and just kind of like a neutral ball position, not trying to do anything too crazy, and let the loft and the design of the wedge do the work. You don't have to manipulate too much.
Exactly. If you have a pretty neutral setup, ball middle, not too much shaft lean, you're going to be okay with it. And it depends on each person as well. Like you said, there might be some guys like the guy you talk about. Myself, I grew up in the Peltz era, so I actually lean the shaft forwards a lot. And you know what? I don't suffer with bounce issues, you know, all the things. I don't suffer with digging, even though I have a hell of a lot of forward shaft lean. And the reason why is I also have an upward hand path. I don't want to go too much into that, but it just goes to show that there are more variables than just bounce. You know, an upward hand path can help to create a bigger margin for error as well.
There's a lot of variables. And I would say you kind of have to, with wedge play, defer to what is comfortable in producing functional shots. It can be a part of the game where it's kind of personalized. But like for me, I did play that, you know, I grew up with that method. And as I got older, it didn't work out as well for me. And I'm having more success, you know, doing the neutral approach on most wedge shots, just because I do have that shaft lean problem. And I do dig sometimes, that's a problem for me. So I found that, you know, middle of the stance, trying to be neutral has helped me. So wrapping up the equipment part of it, you want to get your lofts right, proper gapping. You want to have a variety of sole designs for different lies and different course conditions. And you really want to get that lie angle done properly. There's some other stuff like shaft. I won't go into that. And last but not least, wedges are the only club in your bag that wear out. You know, you can have a set of irons for 10 years. They'll be fine. Driver's going to be fine. But if you play a lot of golf, especially like in sandier conditions, I replace my wedges every 12 to 18 months. And once you start seeing some visible wear on the club face, that's when you know it could be time to change. And my last point on this will be that, and this is something I learned from Woody Lashin, when your wedges start getting worn out, it's like tires on a car that are worn out. They'll operate properly when the road conditions are fine. So if you're on the fairway with a really good lie with a worn out wedge, you can still spin it plenty well. But like a worn out tire, if you start getting on a slick road, well, then all of a sudden it can start skidding. So the real problem with a worn out wedge is when you start having tougher lies where you can't get as clean contact, that's where you'll start losing a lot of spin on the ball. And I've done tests on this where I've lost like 500, 600, 700 RPMs on wedge shots with an older wedge. So again, it's not in everyone's budget, but it's the only club in your bag. You don't need to replace your driver every 2 years, but you might need to replace your wedges. And mostly you'll suffer on not being able to spin it on tougher lies, not necessarily those perfect lies on the fairway. So that's my closing thoughts on wedge equipment.
I finished the last episode talking about how I look at lie first. So I just want to elaborate on that a little bit. So when you are approaching a wedge shot, you're obviously taking in how far it is and things like that. But the first thing I look at, and this is true of most good players, we look at the lie first, because that's going to determine what is possible with this shot. So if I walk up to it and it's a horrible lie, it's sitting in a divot, then I can rule out having lots of bounce on the club. And I can rule out a shallow angle attack. Basically, I have to hit a steeper angle attack with less bounce for that. Whereas when you have a good lie, more options are available to you. You can hit with less bounce, more bounce. There's more things that you can play around with. But a bad lie, that's going to limit what you can do. So you're looking at, is there stuff behind it? Long grass? Or if you're in a divot, there's going to be ground behind it. And you're also looking at, what is the cushion underneath the ball? This is something most players miss. And so I get kids to actually get down on their hands and knees and have a look at the ball and imagine that they are an ant. And I say, what does an ant see here? Is it sitting on a big cushion of grass, or is it tight to the ground? Because again, that determines what bounce you can or should use. And then lastly, I look at what loft I can or need for this shot. So does it require a high shot, or would a low shot suffice? So there's a kind of order to it there. Angle of attack first, is there stuff behind it? Bounce second, so what's the cushion like underneath the ball? And then loft third, what does the shot in front of you or the scenario in front of you determine? If it's tucked close to a pin that's over a bunker, then you might need more loft. But again, there's a strategy part in that. It's like some people take on silly shots that they shouldn't. They're never going to get close. If you're hitting out of a divot in long rough to a pin that's 30, 40 yards away, tucked over a bunker, you're probably silly to take that one on unless your name's Phil Mickelson. You're probably better off just hitting towards the middle of the green and two-putting from there. Yeah, so some examples of that, you know, if you walk up to a shot and you're in thick rough and there's a good cushion underneath it and you need a high shot, well, if it's thick rough, you're going to need a steeper angle of attack, or that will tend to benefit it. If it's a good cushion underneath the ball, you can use lots of bounce, so that's fine. And if you need a high shot, you can add loft to it. So basically, you could use a steep angle of attack with a sand wedge because that has a lot of loft and bounce. If it's thick rough and there's no cushion underneath the ball and you need a high shot, then you're going to still have to use a steeper angle of attack because it's thick rough. But you may have to switch to a lob wedge because a lob wedge tends to have reduced bounce on it, but still has a lot of loft. So there is a lot of decision making that has to go into this. And a huge part of it is just golf education, golfer education, being able to assess the lie and know what type of combination is best for this.
I think a lot of that comes from knowledge about how wedge works. I would definitely recommend, I think James Seekman's book is really good. I don't know if you've read it. I mean, you don't have to agree with every single thing that's in that book, but it's a good updated version. I mean, I love Peltz's Short Game Bible, but I also loved Seekman's book as well. Like it just gave a really good understanding of how wedges work, technique and all that stuff. And I think of knowing how wedges are designed and how they're supposed to work, and combine that with the experience and the experimentation of how I spoke about in the last episode of practicing. So if I'm in my yard, I'm giving myself, or at a short game facility, all different kinds of lies. So if I have like a fluffier lie in the rough, I know that, as Adam said, I have more cushion underneath it, so I'll probably engage more bounce. I'll probably choose my sand wedge, because I know it's going to glide through that rough a little bit easier and pop it out a little bit more effectively. And I know that I'm probably going to need to apply a little bit more force so I don't get those scoopy, fluffy shots that go nowhere, versus when I'm buried, as Adam said, like you're going to have to get steeper on it, more loft, less bounce, and kind of dig it out of there. And you have to experiment what you're doing with your setup. You know, if you want to get a little steeper on it, perhaps I'm going to get more weight on my left side. I'm going to exaggerate my takeaway. It's going to be a little bit more wristy, where I can feel like I can get that club kind of landing straight down on it and limiting the amount of time it's going to spend in the rough.
Let's go that route. So we've got three variables that we need to change. So there's an angle of attack thing.
Yep.
There's a change in loft, and then there's changing bounce. So you're starting to talk about how you change angle of attack. So yeah, let's go down that road. So you said if you want to make a steeper angle of attack, what do you do again? You make a wristier?
For me, my feel is I get weight more on my left side, and I'm probably going to engage my wrists a little bit earlier. I'll probably feel like I'm flicking them open. I don't know if that's the right term. Versus if I had a fluffier lie, I would have a more like, I feel like my wrists are a little bit more frozen. I'm just kind of rotating back and forth, almost like a putting motion. So that would be the difference if I'm going for a shallow angle of attack versus a steeper angle of attack. Depends on the player, what the feel is. But what do you try and do when you want to get steeper on it?
Yeah, similar to yourself. I mean, it depends who you're teaching. If I'm teaching kids, we use the plane analogy. I say, land the plane on this spot and crash land it. And usually a kid, because they're great at self-organizing, will do everything that you just said. You know, they move their weight more onto their left side. That tends to create a steeper angle of attack. They might add more forward shaft lean. At address, that can create a steeper angle of attack, or even through, as you said, hinging your wrists a little bit more vertically, creating a more V-shaped swing will create a steeper angle of attack. Placing the ball back in the stance also creates a steeper angle of attack. Yeah, so those are the main ways that I would create a steeper angle attack. And then you reverse it if you want a shallower angle attack. When would you need a shallower angle attack? If you're on a nice fluffy lie and it's sitting up on top of a fairway turf, you know, it's almost like on bristles, these perfect fairways that you can sometimes play on, then a shallower angle attack is generally more beneficial in that regard. And you can just neutralize those things. So weight more neutral in that regard, shaft lean more neutral, ball position more middle, a wider swing, so less wrist hinge, as you mentioned. So yeah, those are the angle of attack ways. What happens when you get that steeper angle of attack? How does it change the loft generally?
I mean, for me, it would probably end up with me de-lofting it tremendously.
Yeah, in most cases it would. All those things, ball back, weight forward, shaft lean, it takes loft off it. So that's almost one of those disadvantages or trade-offs. Is, yeah, steeper angle attack out of the rough is great, but in most cases, you're reducing loft. So how would you add loft in that situation?
I guess it depends on what situation you're in relative to the green. Because in that situation, if I'm, let's say, putting the ball in the back of my stance, I can't necessarily get my hands further back. That could have a problem with my contact. I mean, the thing that I would try and do is it's just selecting the loft on the club is just getting the lob wedge. That's the most amount of loft I can apply. And also, you know, when you're in jail like that, that's what essentially we're talking about, a buried lie in the rough. You're in jail. So strategically, you're going to I just want to get the ball on the putting surface kind of mode. You're not thinking, especially if you're short-sighted, like forget about trying to land the ball in between you and the pin and getting that perfect one hop on the green rolling on the putting surface. You are simply trying to get the ball out of the rough onto the putting surface so that you can eliminate a double bogey. That would be my main concern in that instance, is that I'm in jail. I know I have to get steep on it, choose the lob wedge to add as much loft as I can. But again, I'm not going to be able to spin it and I'm not going to be able to pop it up that well. It's almost accepting that situation rather than trying to get a little too hero-y with it, if that makes sense.
That's what I meant when I said the lie determines what you can do. If you have a bad lie, you're pretty much in jail with a steeper angle of attack, and then that goes hand in hand usually with a lower loft. So that's the hardest shot in golf in a way, is if you're in a bad lie and you have to hit a high shot. It can be done. It certainly can be done, but you're probably better off than most people just accepting that you just hit the middle of the green from there. But in terms of adding loft or even changing loft, changing club is the easiest way, obviously. Go to a higher lofty club, a lob wedge. That is a way of doing it with little bounce or with less bounce. So if you change to a lob wedge, that's a good way of adding loft with less bounce. If you want to add loft and add bounce, then opening up your sand wedge can work, or just leaning the shaft back a little bit more. That is a way of adding loft and bounce together. So again, it depends what combination you need, right? Is there a cushion under the ball, or is it on a hard pan lie? And sometimes you can get those shots that are in rough where you need that steep angle of attack and there's no cushion underneath it. You know, it's a really horrible one. What else can we do? A more aggressive release. And what I mean by that is letting the club head overtake the hands. That can add loft as well. That adds bounce as well. So those are the options, really. And you can reverse those if you need a lower loft. There's very few situations where you need a lower loft. And probably the easiest way to get a lower loft is just to change down a club. But yeah, you can reverse those things. Square the face up for a lower shot, shaft lean more forwards at address, and a less aggressive release. So, you know, the leaning forwards and keeping it forwards through the shot if you need that low punchy shot.
I probably mentioned this in the last episode. I always value simplicity. I really only have two starting points with wedge shots, and then maybe I'll do a little bit of manipulation if we get into that jail situation. I kind of have my stock neutral, like, maybe I wouldn't call it a putting, but more of like a gentle rocking of my body and not using my hands as much, not a lot of wrist hinge, where I'm just trying to create like a neutral, get the ball rolling type of shot. And then I have my high trajectory. Perhaps I get a little wrist hinge early. I can hit it higher, but I'm not using that often. I feel like I'm almost playing that neutral shot most of the time and adjusting with Really only a sand wedge and a lob wedge. I'm not a huge proponent of using like six different clubs around the green.
You teach a stock shot. And then from there, the next part in the education, I might show someone how you would change the angle attack. Because that's the thing that you can't change by club selection, right? You've got your lob wedge and your sand wedge, but you need a technical solution to change angle of attack. So it's like, okay, if you need a steeper angle of attack, these are your options. And I just introduce them one at a time. I'd say, let's try putting a little bit more weight on the left side, and then you can get a steeper angle attack. Let's put it more neutral. Now it's shallow. Off you go. Go and practice that for a week. And then they come back next time, and I'd say, let's see how ball position changes angle of attack. And so you're just adding these things on layer by layer. I know this is a little bit of a brain dump of a podcast, and I don't expect everybody to take on board everything I've said here, but it's one of those things for me as an instructor. I love this stuff because there's so many different combinations and options and variables to manipulate. It just really satisfies the intellect. And I could practice short game all day because of that, because of all the variables and combinations you can have.
And then when I put my practical golf hat on, that just straight up terrifies me. And then my instinct is to tell everyone, like, no, don't do that. I want everyone to be good at one stock shot, and then like build that first, and don't try and do six things. And you're in agreement with that. I know I'm busting your chops a bit. I think you need to get proficient with one like straightforward technique that you can rely on, knowing that, okay, most times I'm going to make clean contact with the ball, you know, decent ground contact, and I can get this thing headed towards the green on the putting surface. As I said in the other episode, eliminating those shooting yourself in the foot situations where you don't get the ball on the putting surface. That's what I want for every golfer. Get that shot first.
So yes, do your stock setup. So that's going to be ball roughly middle, weight slightly on the left side, little bit of forward shaft lean. That's your stock stuff there. You can play almost every shot from there. If you need a steeper angle of attack, then you just put a little bit more weight on the left side and ball a little bit farther back. That will be enough for a bad lie.
Yeah, I think that would solve it for most people.
Yeah, and then the other stuff you can change with club selection. If you need a higher shot, play a higher loft. If you need a lower shot, play a lower loft. And if you need less bounce, play a club with less bounce. If you need more bounce, play a club with more bounce. So a sand wedge instead of a lob wedge. So that's the basic that I would leave everybody with, that's a little bit more advanced than just the stock shot.
And honestly, like, I was playing golf for, I don't know, 15 years without having any idea what the difference between a sand wedge and a lob wedge was in terms of the grind design. So I think hopefully a lot of people listening to these last two episodes will just understand that, like, yeah, one club has a lot more relief built into it, and it's appropriate for those situations where you're going to need to slide the club underneath if there's cushion underneath it. Versus the other club in your bag, which likely is the highest lofted one, has the least amount of relief built into it. Not that it doesn't have bounce and it can't slide underneath. It can, but it would be more appropriate more for those digging shots, like those jail shots we talked about. So I hope that, you know, bit of information kind of cleared up some things for people.
Well, for people who are often, they ask, how much bounce do I need for a given shot? The simplest way, and the way that I use, is I just set my club on the ground and I have a look. What's that leading edge doing relative to the ground? Most people don't pay attention to these type of things. So if that leading edge is sitting up a lot, you're probably going to need the club with less bounce, you know, if you're on a hard pan lie. Whereas if the leading edge is level with or at the base of the ball, and you're actually fine with the bounce that you have.
I think most golfers are playing courses that, you know, don't have like very closely mown areas.
You're speaking from a guy who came from links turf, British links turf,
yeah, okay.
Where you're playing on snooker tables.
Yeah,
those
exactly.
Are
yeah.
Fairways.
For our UK and Australian listeners, who I know we have, you're probably cursing at me right now. I'm more talking about the wetter, lessly mown American parkland courses, which is probably like, I don't know, 70-80% of American golf. You're going to be fine utilizing bounce and wedge relief on a lot of lies because, you know, most golf courses, it takes a lot of money in terms of like golf course maintenance to create like super tight lies that are drier. you know, I think most golfers can use the bounce on a lot of shots. But again, if you are playing on like the Australian sand belt area, like, yeah, that you're not going to use a lot of bounce on those tight lies over there. And I've struggled. I went to a golf trip at Cabot Links up in Canada where it's like super sandy. I think it's the only official links course in North America by the actual rules of it. And I was really struggling. I was digging, like I couldn't get my wedge play right the first few days. It really threw me for a loop coming from like Northeast United States where we have bent grass and just totally different conditions. You have to know the types of conditions you play in and apply these principles to them.
It's interesting how the environment actually develops the golfer's technique as well. You know, when I played with lots of links golfers, you had these guys who were off plus five and they could shoot incredible scores around these links courses, yet they never really made it. Links golf develops that very forward shaft leaning, steeper angle of attack.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
because you gotta dig. I mean,
you're playing under the wind for one, but the type of turf that you're playing off as well, they get their low points really far forward. They're digging in with very little bounce. And so that suits links golf, obviously. But when you try and play on the American tour and you need these high, soft landing shots, it can be much more difficult to make that work. I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but are there a hell of a lot of British guys on tour dominating? I mean, McIlroy is probably one of them, but McIlroy hits it high, doesn't he? Yeah, maybe this is a topic for another one, but
we could do that separately. But yeah, I mean, if you look at more tour players, they're at least on the PGA tour playing in American courses, they're definitely using bounce on a lot of shots. Like they're not digging, you know, they're using a lot of relief on those wedges. We did get some good questions on Twitter and we're going to try and rapid fire these. Okay. Here's the first question. You both recommended a stock shape for full swings, only deviating from it when absolutely necessary. Would you recommend the same for wedge trajectories? My answer is yes. I don't like people feeling like they want to hit the ball in like five different windows with their wedges. I'd rather you get good at that kind of neutral technique, know what to expect from it, and then choose the right club for the situation.
Yep, I'm exactly the same. Stock shot for 90% of the shots, maybe a couple of changes to your setup to be able to hit higher shots if you need it. But for most of the shots, stock is good.
Here's another one. I think this is a good one. We're probably talking about face angle. When you open the face up of a wedge, do you need to aim more left of your target? And this is for a right-handed player, of course. Adam, you tackle that first.
Yes, but it's not a one-to-one. If you open the face 45 degrees, you do not need to aim 45 degrees left. Yeah, it's not a one-to-one. So as you open that face up, the face just points up more. So you can actually play a lot of shots quite square, with a quite a square stance, especially if you drop the handle. And what I mean by that is get the hands lower, closer to the ground, so the club shaft is flatter. That brings the face back into alignment. So many people will just open the face, drop the hands a little bit, and then play a similar shot with more speed.
I don't want to open up the can of worms here, but that's a more advanced way to get more loft, especially in the bunkers. Get those hands lower. You often see tour players exaggerating that in the bunker. Their hands are super low and they're almost like have reverse shaft lean because they want to get as much loft as possible on the club. All right, here's a good one. Clean versus dirty grooves. First of all, Andrew Rice has done a lot of research on this. He has some really cool YouTube videos. So I look at this where he's kind of sprayed water on the face, put dirt. I've done some testing of my own. I'll refer to this here where I kind of put a ton of dirt on the club face and then some water. Essentially, you're losing anywhere from like 25 to 50% of spin with most wedges. And again, this depends the type of wedge you have. A more premium wedge, like I have Ping Glides, they're really good wet. I actually found no difference when the club face was wet. So if you have a good wedge and they're clean grooves, it will fight against this a bit more, but it's super important to have a really clean club face. If it's dirty, I actually found water was the bigger problem. So you always want to wipe that face down. If you're like, if let's say you're playing a dew sweep around in the morning, you really want to clean that club face before your last practice swing after the shot, before the shot, of course. And then dirt, I didn't find as much, but yeah, it's just going to reduce friction. It's just creating more substances between the golf ball and the club, and you need more of that with wedge play. So yeah, clean your clubs. Have you done any experimentation with that?
Yeah, I found the same thing as everybody else. The same thing as what you just said. So we can move on to the next question.
Ball position. Someone was asking, like, do you like to change the ball position for chips and pitches? There's a lot of conflicting info, and there is. I don't like changing it all that much. I'd rather neutral, aside from those situations we talked about.
Yeah, neutral for most of your shots. If you want something more advanced, farther back in the stance is steeper and lower. Further forward in the stance will be a shallower angle of attack and higher loft. But you can only do the forward in the stance if you have a really good lie.
All right, here's a good one that always, and this is a result of watching golf on TV. Everyone wants to know how to hit that one hop stop wedge shot that you see these guys and women doing on TV.
The one that even I can't do, yeah.
Yeah, I still have yet to do it, but everyone wants it in their bag. I mean, there's a few reasons why we can't do it, but...
I can do it, but I have to be playing on a tour quality golf
course.
You know, when I've, and I have done that. I've played on, I can't remember the one in Miami, Bears Trap, and it was right the week or a couple of days after they played the event there. And it was just like playing a different game. I mean, you're on the fairway, you're walking along, and all you hear is this crunch, crunch, crunch under your feet because you're basically walking on bristles. This grass is just sitting up perfectly. And the same for the grass on the green as well. When you hit the shot into the green, it just spins like you'd never believe. So you've got to be going into a good quality green. You've got to be going in from good quality fairways as well. You've got to have a high spinning ball, which most are these days. And you've got to have enough spin loft as well. So spin loft is a difference between angle of attack and loft. But there's one thing, you've got to have enough speed to create that shot as well. If you're hitting a 10-yard shot, you're probably not going to get that ball to back up. You're going to need to be hitting 50, 60 plus yards because you're going to have enough club speed to create the spin there.
Most of the times we don't even have the ability to do it just because of the turf conditions. Like I've noticed when I've played in several tournaments, I found that I remember playing in a tournament where I was just like ripping the ball off the green and I was like, what is going on? And it was the combination. It had rained the day before, but then they like cut and rolled the greens. So they were like receptive greens. They were soft, but they were really fast, probably like a 12 or a 13. And the fairways were closely mown too. So it created perfect conditions for tons of spin on the green. It's just something that I wouldn't aspire to hit this shot. I wouldn't try to hit it because, like Adam said, you do need a lot of speed. Like you watch tour players, the wedge shots they hit, they're really like aggressive, like the way they come through the ball. So between the turf conditions and your technique, I don't think it's a shot that most people should aspire to play. Plan for the ball to release a bit. That's okay.
It's just something that happens as a result of other things. One thing we didn't talk about is the contact, right? Contact
yes.
is key.
If it's gotta be
you want to get that ball first, if you're getting debris trapped between the face and the ball, then that's going to reduce friction, reduce spin. You're going to get a higher launching. Did people know this? When you reduce friction, the ball launches higher with less spin. That's effectively what a flyer is, a flyer lie. Whereas when you get maximum friction, so nice, dry, clean grooves, good ball first contact, that increases friction, which results in a lower launch with an increased spin. So lots of the reasons why these pros hit these good shots because they're using lots of speed, perfect contact, brand new wedges, and they're from perfect fairways into perfect greens. It's just all this combines to create that spin.
You plan most wedge shots based on landing point and trajectory. If you're going to run it out more, you're going to land it sooner on the green versus if you can add more loft to it and stop the ball with essentially a steeper descent angle, then it won't roll out as much. So I'm always trying to evaluate shots on that. Where am I going to land it on the green? And then how is the ball going to release? I'm certainly not playing for, you know, pulling the cord on it. So don't pursue that shot. I thought that was a good one to address. We actually covered a ton of these questions just throughout the episode with how we approached each shot. One more question we'll talk about, and I've done some testing on this. Someone was asking, is it worth practicing mid-range wedge shot with range balls? And I think what this person's alluding to is really the quality of the ball. And I've done some testing on this. So range balls, they're not very good quality balls, as you would imagine. There's kind of no standard for them. The covering on them is not premium. They're not going to have the same core as a premium golf ball, so you can't spin it as much. That being said, for wedge shots, the difference in yardage won't be that extreme just because it's a smaller percentage and a smaller absolute number versus, you know, hitting your driver, there could be 10, 20, 30 yard difference. So if you're hitting a wedge shot on the range and it's going 55 yards and maybe it would have gone 58 yards with a premium ball, that doesn't scare me that much just because like no one has that much precision on the course anyway. You just want a general window. So I still think you can practice with range balls, perhaps take it with a small grain of salt, but it's not going to be like you're hitting a 40 yard wedge shot and on the course it would be 70 yards. It's not going to be like that.
Yeah, if you're looking at carry distance, for the most part, it's fine. It obviously depends on the quality of the range ball, but most range balls are going to carry about as far as a premium ball on a pitch shot. In terms of working on your strike quality, which is huge in pitching, then there's no reason why you can't do it. Where I'd avoid using range balls really is if you're going to a practice facility and you're actually hitting into a real green in order to look how the ball is at how the ball is reacting on the green. That's where you'd probably want to get your own golf balls out and use some of those instead.
That's a really good point. I've definitely noticed they won't grab as much. You just can't spin them as much in most cases if you are playing with a premium golf ball. Last point I'll make is that, yeah, if you do want some spin around the greens, you know, playing a multi-layer three-piece golf ball with a urethane covering, you know, Pro V1, Bridgestone, TaylorMade TP5, all of those good balls, they will spin more around the green for those shots rather than like, let's say, your noodle ball, something like that. I think we've hit our hour mark. We've covered all our questions. We got all the things we missed in episode one. So
I'm done. I've had enough of you now.
Yeah, I think we're done with each other.
My wife's got some cheese and some wine waiting downstairs for me. We're going to have a picnic in the house today.
It's nice. Windy out,
so yeah.
Good for you. I'm about to watch a movie with my wife.
Are we going
to
do movie recommendations on this podcast as well? We could do that.
Maybe we can do another one. The good thing is about this episode is I escaped bedtime. I got to say goodnight. We're doing this on a Sunday night, Eastern Standard Time, where I live. So I got to say goodnight to my kids and miss a whole hour and a half of bedtime tonight. So my wife's taking the fall for me tonight. So I'm just going to go straight to movie time after this. Anyway, you guys don't care about that. You care about our golf advice. So thanks for listening. Don't forget to check out Adam's 8-week course. I think everyone can learn from it.
And you, John?
Yeah, and you can just go practical-golf, see what I've got to offer, and we will come up with the topic for you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.